We're going to be looking into insights from Harav Soloveitchik into Megillat Esther. And I think we should begin by realizing that we are living in Purim times. Very much we are feeling vulnerable. We're living in Galut. And we feel threatened in the same way that we were threatened in the times that we were in the Malchus Achashverosh, when all kinds of accusations could be leveled against us. And we had to figure out on our own initiative and with as much help from Hashem as we could receive, what to do. For example, right now, what do we have to do with Venezuela and its economy? And yet Hugo Chavez, the head of Venezuela, accuses the Jews, and somehow that's supposed to divert his people's attention from the fact that the economy is faltering. In Iran, a community that was there for over 2,000 years has now almost disappeared completely. There are very few Jews left in Iran. And even so, Ahmadinejad can rail against Jews and see murdering Jews as the only solution to all the world's problems. In general, Islam is going through a lot of internal divisions right now and a lot of external difficulties in dealing with the culture of the West. And somehow the Jew gets caught in between. What do we have to do with India and Pakistan? And yet in Mumbai, Jews got killed. So we see that we're very much living in Purim kind of times. And in fact, when we say the Achenu Kol Beis Yisrael, that we say on Monday and Thursday, it's said at the end of reading the Torah, we can say it right before the second Ashrei. I think if we look at it, we can see how very much we feel the kinds of feelings that are expressed here. We say Achenu Kol Beis Yisrael, our brothers, all the house of Israel, Hanasunim Basara Ubashibya, who are given into distress and captivity, Ha'omdin Bein Bayamu Bein Bayabusha, who find themselves standing between the sea and the dry land, Hamakom Yinachem Alehem V'yotzei Meitzara L'Ravacha, Hashem should have pity on them, should have mercy on them, and should take them out from distress to relief, Me'afel Al Arvadol, from dark, the pain in the eye, Aleph that we use here, it should be Me'afel, Me'afel Al Ora, from darkness to light, Mishibud L'Gula, from servitude to delivery to freedom, Hashka, now, Bagoa Spili, Bisman Kariv, and soon the Ruah Main. And I think that every morning when we say that, every Monday and Thursday when we say that, we're very aware of Gilad Shalit, and we're very aware of the fact that there's somebody who's actually in captivity right now, and we're very aware of the fact that many things are happening, and we don't know why they're happening as they do. But what our salvation recommends is that instead of asking why things are happening, we have to ask how to cope with them and what we should do about them. And in fact, his whole attitude toward the Shoah was not to ask why it happened, but to ask, now that it happened, what do we learn from it and how can we cope in the future? And that's why the story of Purim, as you see in the second source, V'hagamim ha'elen yisrim v'nasim b'chol dar v'dar, mishpacha v'mishpacha, medina v'medina, v'ir v'ir, the message of the Megillah is relevant in every generation. It's relevant to every family, to every province, to every city. And these days of Purim will not pass from among the Jewish people, and the memory of them will not perish from the seed of the Jewish people, from the descendants of the Jewish people. Because as long as we're in Galut, as long as we're in exile, we're vulnerable. And even in the land of Israel right now, we're vulnerable with the kinds of neighbors that are surrounding us. And we have to take a lesson from the Megillah in how to react to all the difficulties that face us. Rav Soloveitchik says there are four lessons that the Megillah teaches us for how to deal with the vulnerability of the Jew. He says the first lesson is, we have to realize that we may have faith in man, we may try to trust people, but our faith in man should not blind us to the fact that there's a demonic element in man. There's an element in man that we just don't understand, that is cruel, and that reacts with cruelty for no reason that we can fathom. An irrational, monstrous quality that there is in man for no reason. We certainly have seen it in our time in Hitler, Yimach Shemo, and in Stalin. Who killed for that reason. Now as we find out more about Saddam Hussein and other people and what they did in their countries, we find out that there are some people who can kill tens of thousands of people without any qualms, without any feeling of conscience about it. So the first thing about salvation says we have to learn from the Purim story is not to put our faith in men, not to be blind to the terrible things that men can do. He feels that the second thing we can learn from the Purim story is that every upheaval has dire possibilities in it for the Jew. That the Amalek in man, this nasty, hating attitude toward the Jewish people, and this preoccupation with making Jews suffer, goes on and on through the generations. So that whatever upheaval happens, we have to watch out for what it will portend for the Jewish people. And I think to myself about the communist regime, the rise of communism and the fall of communism. When communism was rising, the Tsarist government went out against the Jewish people and was trying to imprison Jewish people because the Tsarist government said that it was Jews who were formulating the communist program. It was Marx, it was Trotsky, and there were Jewish members in many of the cells. Of course, it was very idealistic young Jewish people who thought the communism was going to somehow solve the problems of rich and poor. So the Tsarist government was out to imprison and to kill Jews. Then when the communism became the dominant force in Russia, and when the Communist Party took over, what happened in the 1930s? A sudden turning against the Jewish people that continued for decades afterward, culminating in that infamous doctor's plot, which was only stopped by the death of Stalin. So somehow, no matter what the change is, whether there's an economic change, whether there's a political change, whether there's a social change, the Rav Soloveitchik says we always have to watch out because there are always dire possibilities in it for the Jew. And I am very much davening to Hashem that now that we have Jews in such prominent positions in the government, at a time when the whole world economy is falling apart, that things don't depend on people like Rahm Emanuel, who's so obviously Jewish, that we have to be very wary of which way things will turn at a time of upheaval in the world. We also have to realize the third lesson from the Purim story is that a common destiny encompasses all Jews. That we are united by the fact that we're threatened the way we are, and that there's no such thing as a Jew saying, I'll get away from the fate of the Jews. And we saw that, for example, in Western Europe, where Jews were very assimilated in the 1920s and the 1930s, and yet somehow, as Rabbi Zipperstein, Zichrono Livracha, Rosh Yeshiva, why you put it, Hitler Yimach Shmo was the best philosopher. We all debated who is a Jew, but somehow he knew who is a Jew, and he knew exactly where to find us, and he knew exactly how to try to annihilate us. So then Rav Soloveitchik says the Purim story teaches us the common destiny that unites all Jews. But finally, lest I end on such an unhappy note that there is terribly demonic forces within man, there are terribly demonic forces, that every upheaval has dire possibilities for the Jew, that a common destiny unites all of us and a common enemy threatens all of us. On the other hand, Hashem intercedes whenever total destruction faces the Jewish people, and Hashem does not allow our people to get destroyed. And certainly 1948 was an excellent example, 1967 was an excellent example again, where we should have given the credit to Hashem instead of in 1968 having a military parade on the anniversary of the Six-Day War saying, Kol HaKavod L'Tzahal, Titzah HaGanah L'Umit, we should have said instead, Kol HaKavod L'Hashem, that the miraculous things that happened in 1967 happened as they did. But Hashem always intercedes, and the Jewish people is never without someone to save us. Now, Rav Soloveitchik gives a psychological reading to the whole story in the Megillah, and he sees the development of different characters. He sees the development of Ahasuerus, although it's not much of a development. Ahasuerus pretty much is, we'll see in a minute what happens with Ahasuerus. We see the development of Esther, who goes from being an innocent young girl, who's very much under the tutelage of her uncle. Anything that Mordechai says to her, Esther Osa, she is very much following what she's told to do by the man who brought her up. We see the shifting roles of Mordechai and Esther. As Esther grows in her position and realizes what Mordechai tells her, who knows why you ascended to being queen, and now we have to figure out the reason, and as they figure out the reason, Esther becomes more and more of an active person rather than a passive person just accepting Mordechai's instructions. And finally, we see the undoing of Haman, Yimach Shemo, and he's going from being such a top person to reversing and going to being at the bottom, being hung on the gallows. And we see that throughout, Esther is playing a psychological game. She has to play on the king's paranoia. And it's Esther's realization of this, and it's Esther's realization of how to use this for the benefit of the Jewish people, that's the story in the Megillah. Unfortunately, there's not a big change in Achashverosh, and as you'll see at the end of my talk, that's something that Esther has to cope with. She has to cope with the fact that he's that same Achashverosh that he was in the beginning, and he's still a very whimsical person, and she can never tell if the Jewish people are completely safe with him. She can't tell when he'll get an idea in his mind like the idea he had for Vashti, and Chas v'Shalom do the same to her. But that's part of the Gullah story, that's part of the vulnerability. So let's look at the third source. Vayehi bimei Achashverosh. Hu Achashverosh hamalek mehodu v'akush sheva v'esrim meyav adina. Vayehi bimei, whenever it starts with Vayehi bimei, it means that something tragic is going to happen. In the same way that the story of Rus begins with Vayehi bimei shvot hashoftim, and it wasn't the days when the judges ruled, and it was a time when things were not going as they should, and when an important man like Elimelech could take his wife Naomi and could take their sons, and go off to another country at a time of suffering among the Jewish people. So it's saying something was going wrong at this time. And by Vayehi bimei Achashverosh means we were living in a difficult time and something threatening was going to happen. And what is it about Achashverosh? We find out from our Mefarshim that he was an upstart. He was a man who led a revolt, who married the king's daughter, because that was one of the ways that you showed in those times that you were in charge, by marrying the daughter of the king. And actually, his origins were from the horse stables of the king, where his father worked in the stables. So this is a man who had risen very far from being the son of the man who took care of the king's horses to being the king. And the Malbim explains that, therefore, he had political goals. He very much wanted to take power to himself and to show that he's in charge and that Vashti is subservient. So he wanted to show that she may be the king's daughter, and I married her to prove that I have complete control over here in the royal house, but I really have to show it in a very definite way. So, for example, he makes this big party, and who does he invite to this party? He invites Lemi Gadol, the Ad Katan, from the very great people to the smallest person. Because what he's trying to show is the old elite is not the elite anymore. The old hierarchy doesn't obtain anymore. And now I'm making a whole new social order in this kingdom. He moves the center of the kingdom from Babel to Shushan to show I'm in charge and I make the capital where I choose it to be. And to show how he has absolute power in dealing with Vashti, first of all, and this is interesting because there's a lot of different things about women's role in Megillas Esther, she makes a Mishten Nashim. She makes a party that's only for women. He doesn't want her to be around the Sarid, around the different officials and the different important people. He doesn't want her talking with anybody who's an officer in the government. He wants to very much put her down and let her know you can make a party with the women and that's all that you're good for. And where does she make it? Beis HaMelech Asher LaMelech HaChashverosh. She makes it in one of his palaces. She doesn't have a palace of her own. She no longer has any sphere of influence of her own. She's entirely under Achashverosh's thumb. And when the men have a drunken debate on the seventh day of the party about which women are the most beautiful, whether the women of Paras or Madai, Achashverosh, in his own drunkenness, can say, no, the vessel that I use is the best vessel, which is quite a way to talk about a woman. That's in the Medrash. And he says, let Vashti come. And the men who are all drunk insist that she should come naked in front of them to show her beauty. Now, Vashti, before she even knows that full extent of that command, knows how he's sending for her. And how does he send for her? Yad HaSarisim, through his emissaries, which is another way of putting her down. So, of course, Vashti says no to this. And the king cannot handle any kind of dispute with his authority, which is why he turns to his advisors for what to do. And that's why one of his advisors, Mumuchan, comes up with this great idea that Yetzei Tvar HaMelech, and the decree should go out from the king. It should be absolute. You have absolute power, and you can be rid of her. And you see the paranoia in other ways as well, not only in having to show his wealth, and not only having to have this big party, and not only in having to win the allegiance of everybody from top to bottom, but you see it in a few of the rules that he makes that come out later on. For example, that nobody can come into his throne room without being invited in. Well, that's a way of preventing a rebellious attack against him. No assassin can come in if nobody's allowed to come into the throne room except if you're asked to come. Or the rule that the king has to extend his scepter to the person who's coming. Well, that gives him another 2 or 3 feet before an assassin can come with a knife or a sword to attack him and gives him time for his guards to defend him. So you see that everything that Ahasuerus is doing shows a very insecure man who wants absolute power and is not convinced yet that he has it. And with every proof that he tries to establish of it, he worries a little bit more, which is why he takes on one trusted advisor, Haman, because he figures that at least I'll have one person that I know can be totally on my side. And to show Haman how completely he trusts him, he gives over his signet ring. When Haman comes with this idea of getting rid of a nation, Ahasuerus doesn't even ask for the name of the nation. All he has to do is hear that there's one nation that's scattered throughout the 127 provinces, and they just might be able to unite and get messages to each other to rebel against him. That's all he has to hear, and he's ready to murder an entire people. So this tells you something about Ahasuerus, that he's coarse, that he's from a low life kind of background, that he's impetuous, that he's paranoid. But even a paranoid person can have real enemies. And you see with Big Son and Seresh plotting to kill him by giving him a poison drink, that there's reason for him to be afraid, that there are plots going on against him. And Rav Soloveitchik compares and contrasts his attitude on the seventh day of the party to what a Jewish attitude is for the seventh day. Because on the seventh day, Vayehi b'yom ha'shvi'i k'tov lev ha'melech b'yayin, what happens to Ahasuerus when he drinks? He gets coarse, and he gets into very vulgar discussions with his people about beauty and very vulgar ways of proving it. And that's what happens to him b'yom ha'shvi'i. Wine comes into him, and his true nature comes out. Our Chachamim tell us, Nichnas Yayin Yatzah Sod, that when wine comes into a person, the secret nature of the person comes out, reveals itself. Of course, with us, it reveals itself at that fourth cup of wine on the Seder when people fall asleep. So that's one way of revealing itself. But with Ahasuerus, it reveals itself. It is becoming even more coarse and even more vulgar. And Rav Soloveitchik compares it to the Yom HaShvi'i of the Jewish people. On the seventh day, what we do is we try to ascend spiritually. And we have Shabbos. And yes, we have wine, but the wine is to sanctify the day. And the wine is to elevate us spiritually. Or we have Atzeres, the day at the end of the Yom Tovim, the day at the end of Sukkos and of Pesach, the day after Shavuos. Atzeres, it's a day of restraint. It's a day of complete dedication to Hashem. And we're told in Dvarim, Yom HaShvi'i Atzeres LaHashem Elokecha. For us, the seventh day is a day to rise spiritually. Of course, for us, it's the eighth day in Golos because of Yom Tov Sheni Shel Golios. But in a society like Ahasuerus is, the seventh day is a day to really get into your cups, to really get into your wine, and to reveal just what a beastly person one is. And what do we see? That under the veneer of civilization, and under the veneer of all the beautiful gold cups and magnificent tapestries and all the other wonderful trappings of civilization that are shown in his palace during those 180 days and then the 7-day party, but underneath it, there's an ugly brute who can announce an edict right away. As soon as Haman suggests to him there might be a revolt by his people, he can announce an edict they should all be murdered on the 13th of Adar, the day that Haman chooses through a poor, through a lot. And that's why, number 4, B'yom HaShvi'i K'tov Lev HaMelech B'Yayin. What happens afterward? Number 5, Haratzim Yatzim Duchufim B'Dvar HaMelech. The runners go out very urgently at the word of the king. And the edict is given out in Shushan, the law is given out in Shushan, the capital. And what do the king and Haman do? The king and Haman can sit down to drink, and the city of Shushan is bewildered. And that certainly reminds us of the ways that the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, behaved, that they could carry on their ordinary life and their ordinary celebrations while murder was going on. And this is what the king and Haman are able to do. They have no idea of the meaning of what they're doing and the brutality of what they're doing. And of course, at Yir Shushan Avocha, the people of Shushan are bewildered. They've been living in this country. They've been contributing to this country. What is going on here that suddenly there's a 13th day of Adar and they're all supposed to be murdered? And this is my comment, not from Rav Soloveitchik, When you think about the Jews in Germany who lived there for 6 and 7 centuries, some of them in the same town for 7 centuries, and they were stunned when the edicts came against them. It came from nowhere. And when you think of what the Jews had contributed to European civilization, I won't go through all the famous names, but even in government, there was a man named Walter Rathenau who really helped Germany through World War I, even though Germany was defeated. But Rathenau was the one person who tried to make sure that there were supplies for the army and tried to make sure that economically Germany should recover. And yet he was assassinated. Or in France at the same time, Leon Blum, who was a tremendously contributing Jew and got the whole Socialist Party started in France, given over to a concentration camp with no second thought. So what do we have to realize? What we see in number 6, Vayomer ki yad al keska nochama l'Hashem v'amalek dor dor. We have to realize that no matter how much we feel at home in the country, and no matter how much we feel that we're part of that country, still it's a promise of Hashem that there's going to be a war with Amalek from generation to generation. There will always be Amalek elements that come up. And that's why we read this past Shabbos, what you see in number 7, Zacharas Asher Alcha Amalek Adarach Metzesem in Mitzrayim. We always have to remember what Amalek did to us, and we have to remember, Timche Ezecher Amalek Mitachas HaShemayim Lo Tishkach. We have to blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under the heaven, and we cannot forget. Because there will always be an enemy, and we have to be ready for that fact, and we have to realize that we have to use our own initiative to fight the anti-Semite as he comes. We're always more vulnerable than others. No matter what the ideology, we're always threatened. And even now, when there's a division within Islam about different kind of cultural groups within Islam and of Islam vis-a-vis the East dealing with the West, somehow the Jews get involved, and in Pakistan, Jews get killed because Pakistan and India are having divisions. Interesting that we're seen as just one person by the Goyim. We're seen somehow. Just one second while I find which quote I want to use for this. Okay, I'll just say it by heart. Yeshno am echad mufozar mufarad ben hagoyim. That there's a one nation that's scattered among all the peoples. We're never seen in isolation as one person. It's always seen as the stereotype of the Jew, whatever stereotype is chosen. And even when things go well for the Jew, that's also seen in a certain stereotypical fashion. So first Haman can accuse us, Yesh amachad mufozar mufarad ben hagoyim, and Dosehem Shonos Nikol Hamim, and let's get rid of this people that's different from everybody else and has its own ways. Who knows what the rebellion they might foment? We have to get rid of them. But even later on, when Haman has risen and then finds that he's in danger, when he's asked to take Mordechai out for that ride and say, Kacha Yaseh La'isha Sharnoch HaFetz Bikaro, and he comes back to Zeresh and he comes back to all his friends, and what did they say to him? Imi zera hayudim Mordechai asher hakilos l'mpolofanav lo suchalav ki nafol t'mpolofanav lo suchalofanav. Somehow the Jew is seen as all-powerful. So at the same time that we're seen as the group that can unite and rebel and you have to murder us and get rid of us, we're also seen as all-powerful. And suddenly Zeresh and Haman's wife and all his friends can turn and say to him, oh, well, if it's a Jew, you better watch out, because you can't defeat those Jewish people. So this is all part of the stereotype in which we're seen. That's why in number 8, when Haman tells Esrov Ashro, he tells his wealth, and he tells all the ways that the king says elevated, the king has elevated him, and that Esther has brought to the party only one person, Haman, together with the king. But how does he feel? Kolze enenu shoveli b'chol es hashem yiros Mordechai heyudi yoshev b'shar ha'melech. The anti-Semite cannot even enjoy his good fortune as long as there's a Jew around. As long as he sees Mordechai not bowing down to him, then all the elevation and all the wonderful things don't mean anything to him. What did the king do? The king trusted Haman, and the king took off his ring earlier, and gave it to Haman Hamdasa Hagagi, so rare Hayudin, the enemy of the Jews. And the Gemara tells us that when the Jewish people realized they were all being threatened by Haman, and that we're all being put under one term called Jew, what did they realize? The Talmud tells us, Vayasa Hamelech has Tabato, Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana, Gedola Hasaras Tabas, Yosemar, the Englishman in the inn of the Shevan Vios, Israel. The Gemara tells us that when Ahasuerus removed his ring and gave it over to Haman, the whole Jewish people trembled, because we all realize now, no matter how assimilated we are, no matter how much we try to befriend the Goyim, no matter how much we try to become like Paros and Madai, we're all under threat. And it's a little bit ironic, a little bit of a sad smile, that there was more tshuva done because of the removal of that ring and the recognition that we're all together in this than 48 prophets and the 7 prophecies the Jewish people had. That got us more to do tshuva than anything else. Not to think about the Eastern Jew and the Western Jew, the modern Jew and the Haredi Jew. We're all Jews and we're all in it together. And I just mentioned who the 7 prophetesses are because I just thought for a women's learning group it would be important to know who the Gemara says they are. And you'll notice what each one of them has. Sarah, Devorah, Chana, Abigail, Huldah, and Esther. Rav Soloveitchik takes the women of Tanakh as the paradigm for how we should conduct our lives. And each one of them shows a special understanding of what to do. With Sarah, it's Chol Asher Tamari Lecha Sarah Shema B'Kola, Ki B'Yitzchak Yikarei Lecha Sarah, that Abraham should listen to Sarah, she's the one who understands that the lineage will continue through Yitzchak. With Devorah, she's the one who understands that it's time for battle, and she's the one who gets Barak to come and start the battle. Chana understands better than Elkanah what her destiny is. Elkanah, her husband, says to her, isn't it good enough for you that I love you, and my love is better than having 10 children, what are you worried about? But Chana knows that her destiny is to be a Jewish mother. She's to be the mother of Shmuel. And she goes to daven to Hashem and to ask for a child. Abigail is the wife first of a Naval, of a person who's Kishmo Kenhu, a very lowly person. She's the one who stops Naval from going out against David. And she's the one who stops David from killing Naval for the terrible way he behaves to King David. In the end, Naval dies of natural causes. And Abigail marries David HaMelech, who is thankful to her that she saved him from acting impetuously against her husband when her husband insulted him terribly. Huldah is a Neviah, is a prophetess in Melachim Beis, in the 2nd book of Kings, and she is the one who explains to King Yoshiyahu, who has a Sefer Torah found during his reign, but wants to lead the Jewish people in Tshuva. She's the one who explains to him how to do it and tells him what will happen in his time that he will accomplish it. And finally, we have Esther in our reading right now, and we'll see in a minute what her superior understanding is. Because I listed Sarah. Miriam didn't get written down here. Okay, Miriam should be between Sarah and Devorah. Okay, and Miriam is the one. Thank you. Miriam is the one who understood in the time when Jewish men and women stopped living together in Mitzrayim because they said, why should we come together? Why should we have a family life? The children are just going to get killed. Miriam is the one who understood and told her father Amram, Paro Gazar al ha-anashim, and your gozer on the whole people. You have to have children anyway. Maybe they'll be girls, but you have to continue the Jewish people. So Miriam showed great understanding as well. Okay, here we come to the accusation that I was looking for before, that Haman makes against the Jewish people, and now we have to counter it. Now, what is Esther going to do? Here's Ahasuerus the king. Here's Haman, who has absolute power, given to him with Etzabas, and Mordecai sends word to Esther, don't think that you can be separate from the fate of the Jewish people. And Esther says to return an answer to Mordecai. And here's where different things start happening. Because before this, it was always Esmamar Mordecai Esther Osa. Esther did whatever Mordecai told her. And now Esther starts sending messages. She tells her trusted emissary, Lahashiv El Mordecai, or Lahagid Le Mordecai. Esther is starting to grow, and she's starting to develop as an independent person. Because what does Mordechai think that she should do? Mordechai thinks that she should go lavo lehischanen lefnei hamelech, that she should come and plead before the king. But Esther knows what kind of personality she's dealing with. And she knows that she can't just come all of a sudden and appear before the king with a request for the Jewish people. She knows that his emotions have already been played on by Haman. And she's going to have to think of a different way of reversing the situation entirely. And in fact, the Gemara tells us in Talmud Bavli, Vayigan Hashem Elokim Eset Tzela, that Hashem built the woman from the inner rib. The Hashem gave an extra measure of understanding to women more than to men. And Esther is going to have to figure out what to do now with that extra understanding. First of all, she has a gift from Hashem. The gift that she has from Hashem is that Esther had a certain charm, had something special about her, that she found favor in people's eyes. Now, I don't know if Rabbi Reichman gave you the medrash about Esther having been kind of green-hued and not really being beautiful in the most obvious sense of the word. In fact, that's why her name was Esther, like a myrtle being kind of greenish. It wasn't that kind of beauty that she had. But she had an inner beauty. There was a sense of Hashem's spirit within her that people felt when they met her. And if you've ever met people like this, who have this inner spirituality and this inner sense of being in tune with what the Torah is all about, with what Hashem is all about, with what responsibility to Jewish people is all about, that was the kind of chen that Esther had. And we see another person in the Torah who also had chen. Yosef was nosei chen wherever he went. And it's this inner charm from Hashem that's given to these people. She has to now figure out, in a very difficult time, in a kind of time like the time that we're facing, how does she go taking a king from believing in a person who's bent on our destruction into not believing in him. And in the back and forth with Mordechai, he tells her, listen, you're going to have to think of something. And she now transfers and grows from being the person who does what she's told to do and is like the way she was when she was being raised by Mordechai. She realizes there's a reason she got that being chosen to be in the king's house. To be the queen, she must do something with it. She knows that it's hidden from her, and that's why it tells us in the Talmud. How do we know about Esther from the Torah? Because it tells us in number 15, "Vanochi haster astir panai," I will hide my face. And that's the kind of situation that Esther's working in. As Rav Soloveitchik points out, it's the end of the period of prophecy. So where Moshe Rabbeinu could get exact instructions from Hashem about what he had to do with taking the Jews out of Mitzrayim, Esther's not getting those kind of exact instructions. Esther has to figure out herself. And in fact, I just want to quote one paragraph that really expresses exactly what she felt. Rav Soloveitchik says, there was a silent confrontation between mighty historical events and the Jew in the diaspora, between a wicked, cruel monster and a lonely Jewish maiden on whose frail shoulders Providence placed the heavy load of historical responsibility. So she has to act both with courage and with wisdom. And she knows it's not the ministrations of toiletries that she needs in a society that's obsessed with externals and obsessed with sexuality. It's something different that she needs. She needs Ruach Hashem. She needs an understanding from Hashem of what it is that she should do. Where Mordechai knows everything that's going on and understands in number 16, as Kol Asher Nasa, he understands there must be a purpose to it. There has to be some higher meaning to Esther having been chosen, to the Jewish people going through this, and now the question is, what is she going to do? As far as Mordechai is concerned, all he can do is to rip his clothes, to go into mourning, and to lead the people in davening and in lamentation. But Hashem has other ideas in mind, and Rav Soloveitchik regards this as the turning point in the Megillah. Why did the king's sleep escape him? What is it that awakened him? Of course it's Yad Hashem, but there's something that Esther did that made him awaken. That night that he awakened and couldn't sleep, was right after the first party with Haman. And what happens to Achashverosh at the first party? What does he start thinking? If you're a paranoid king, what would be your thought if the queen invited only one other person to the party? They're in cahoots. They must be planning something together against him. And the fact that she invited him to a second party reinforces his feeling of worry. So he starts thinking to himself, what could it be that I forgot to thank someone? What mistake did I make that somebody might be planning something against me? And this is what gets him to start thinking about Haman in a different way. Because when he has Haman come in the middle of his being awake with his worry, and he's thinking, who's trying to get my kingdom away from me? And he asks Haman, what should I do for someone I want to honor? Haman, whose head is full of wanting to kill Mordechai and the gallows that he's having erected for him, and that he's invited to the second party with the queen, he just thinks in terms of, how can I get gedulah? How can I get greatness? And he says, well, let the king have the person dressed in the clothes you wore for your installation as king, and let him ride on the horse that the king rode at that time. What is Achashverosh's reaction to that? Instead of saying, oh, here's my trusted advisor telling me how to make sure that everybody realizes how I treat somebody close to me, Esther has aroused his suspicion. Esther has touched on his paranoia. And his first thought is, oh, so this is what Haman is really thinking about. He's really thinking about taking away the kingship from me. And here's where the reversal happens, the Nahafohu. On that night of the king's insomnia, Esther has started the change happening. Esther has started the reversal happening. And now, when she comes to talk with the king, it's a very different kind of reception she's going to get from him, and it's a very different feeling that he has about the whole kingship, about the whole relationship with Haman. There's already a seed of doubt that's been planted in him. And when Esther comes and talks with him, in number 18, Vatilbash Esther Malchus, Rashi says about that, B'dei Malchus, Rabosenu Amra Shluvashta Ruach HaKodesh. As we see in the Rehayamim, that when you wear something, it says Ruach Lavsha, it's Ruach Hashem. Esther is now realizing that I'm here for a special reason, as we should all realize that we're here for a special reason. And she's realizing that I've risen for a reason. I'm not supposed to be passive anymore. I'm supposed to be active. I'm not supposed to be receiving instructions anymore. I'm supposed to be giving instructions. Which is why she's able to tell Mordechai that all the people should fast for her for 3 days. Sumu olai shoshi amin. She now realizes that she has a part to play, and that the woman is the one who is going to save the Jewish people. And she's able to come on the second night, and here she has a king who on the first night had been secure in his place, but worried a little bit about a revolution, and Haman, who had felt very secure and very elevated. She now has two very different kinds of people to deal with on the second night. She has an Achashverosh who's very worried, what does this Haman have in mind? And she has a Haman who has just come from taking Mordechai through the streets of Shushan and proclaiming his greatness, and whose last message from his wife and friends was, well, if he's a Jew, you're going to fall before him. You're going to be destroyed. So now when Esther can accuse Haman, the king is ready to hear it. And when he rushes out to his parapet outside, to his deck outside, and comes back in and finds Haman pleading in front of the queen, he's ready to see immediately that there's a plot going on against him and to have Haman killed. So that in 24 hours, we go from Haman being at the top and Haman being Sheni Lamalchus to Haman being killed. And yet, the story has not ended for two reasons. First of all, the decrees have to be undone, which is what the 8th and 9th chapters are all about, the undoing of the chapters. But we still have Esther remaining vulnerable, because where is Esther? She's still married to that brute. She's still married to that monster. She's still in the palace of that king. So although it's a happy story, it really is the story of our being in Galut, that we're still vulnerable. And it's always mixed. That defeating Haman is insufficient. We defeat one enemy, but other enemies are going to come up until Yimos HaMashiach. And Esther, in a certain sense, is a tragic heroine. Because although she's grown, and although she has realized how to defeat Haman, And although she was right in her analysis that she shouldn't just come before the king and plead for the Jewish people, that wouldn't have done it. She couldn't have done Haman's power. But she's still stuck living in the palace with Ahasuerus. And Esther has grown. She has changed from being a little girl to being a grown woman who is active and who is planning and who has strategy and who succeeds. Mordechai has recognized her role in saving the Jewish people. Haman is finished. He's gone. So a complete change has happened for him. But we don't see any change in Ahasuerus. He's still the same person, and she still has to live with him. And he can still be whimsical, and he can still do all kinds of things. In fact, that's the explanation that my son gives for a medrash that says that when Esther accuses Haman at the second party, she says, Ish sar v'oyev, Haman hara hazeh. A man who's a terrible enemy to the Jewish people, or to the, in general, a terrible enemy, Haman, this bad person. And the Medrash tells us that an angel pointed her accusing finger, which he was actually pointing to Ahasuerus, and pointed it to Haman. And we have two explanations for that. Rav Baruch Epstein, the Torah Tmima, says that really, she was furious with Ahasuerus for causing this mess. It wasn't just Haman who had made this difficulty. Ahasuerus, through his whole way of being whimsical, through his whole way of not even asking, who are we murdering when we're murdering the entire people, he had had a big part in causing this tragedy, possible tragedy for the Jewish people. But she knew that it wouldn't do any good to deal with Ahasuerus because he's still the one who can make the decrees. It's more important that she overcome Haman's decree, which is why the Medrash tells us that the angel pointed her finger from accusing Ahasuerus to accusing Haman. Although Haman, Ahasuerus really played a part in this whole difficulty. The Vilna Gaon says no, even before Freud talked about Freudian slips, the Vilna Gaon says no, it was subconscious on her part. That what was really on her mind was Ahasuerus' guilt in this whole danger. And she wanted to deal with Ahasuerus. Her subconscious was causing her finger to point to Ahasuerus to say, Ish sar v'oyev, there's an enemy. But the angel, knowing that this would put her in danger and put the whole Jewish people in danger, pointed her finger instead toward Haman as the one who's doing these terrible things. So we see, when we look at Baruch Epstein's explanation that it was conscious that she was about to accuse Ahasuerus, or subconscious, but Esther really knew where our difficulty was coming from. And it was coming from having a capricious person like this in charge of our fate, in charge of our destiny. The Gemara in Megillah tells us that we don't say Hallel in Purim because the miracle happened outside of Israel, and we only say Hallel on a miracle that happened in Israel, and because we were still vulnerable, and because the Megillah is our Hallel. And my husband explains, how is the Megillah our Hallel? It doesn't even have Hashem's name in it. We have it all hidden. It's all Hasera Seer. We see the Yad Hashem. And my husband says the Megillah teaches us how to survive in Golos, even though we'll still be vulnerable. And how does it teach us? By relying on Hashem's hidden ways and by making our own efforts. So that the Megillah is the perfect Hallel to say, is the perfect way to praise Hashem for the kind of miracles that we have now. Because they're always mixed. They're always both a miracle, both a saving, and always going to have a difficulty, we'll still be vulnerable. So we could win in 1967, but then we have to deal with the West Bank and with accusations against us for the next 42 years, of what we're going to do with the Palestinians that were in those territories. That's the kind of victory that we have when we're in Golos. We have a victory that's always a very mixed kind of victory. And this is Rav Soloveitcher's point, that on Purim we're not completely saved. Mordechai still has to come to plead before Ahasuerus for his goodwill. Esther, the tragic heroine, still has to live with him. We still see that there will be confrontations among different cultures, and somehow the Jew will always be at the center of the different confrontations. But ultimately, what we have to do is take the lesson of the Megillah. We're not living in a time of prophecy. We're not told what to do as Moshe was told what to do and as other prophets told us what to do. We're living in a time where we have to use our own initiative, we have to use our own intelligence, and we have to try to figure out, with Yad Hashem guiding us, what to do in Golos. So may this Purim be the last Purim that we're still finding ourselves in vulnerability, May it be the time that it leads to Yemos HaMashiach, when things will be clear and when victories will be complete. I wish you all a good Purim.